Welcome back to Peter Hill Explains, where I explain things scientific, talk about things scientific, and basically give you a tutorial podcast of past HSC questions, leaving questions, the questions given in the physics science exam in the final year of study in Australia. And I'm doing this just to increase my confidence and delivery for return to work eventually, as I overcome from this heart operation. Question 34 from 2017. I wasn't an examiner here, so these questions are fresh. I was actually, I think, still sick in hospital at the time when these came out. So I'll try and go for it. This is quantity quark. This is an option, so at the end of a four-year term, the fourth of four terms, the four-term year, this is something that the school can match with their student population what they would most like to do. So this slightly favours, there may be people interested in geology, people interested in electronics, various things. It allows a little bit of fine-tuning of your science, final year science. It's broken into, five questions broken up, and typically the last questions are 6-mark questions. It goes for 25 marks, and let's just head in. And this is sight unseen for me, so I may make a few mistakes. So it's question 34, subsection or subpart A, subpart 1. And this is the question for 2 marks. State the composition of helium-3, or helium-3 nucleus, in terms of the fundamental particles. Now, this is a quantity quark, so it will often ask you for more. Helium-3 means that there's a total of 3 neutrons and protons. However, because it's helium, it's got 2 protons. So helium-3 will be 2 protons and 1 neutron. I don't think that will get you a full mark. You'll probably have to talk about the quarks. The protons have 2 up and 1 down quark, so you draw that for the 2 protons. And in the neutrons, it's 1 up and 2 down to get a neutral particle. Now, you may be required to draw the diagram of the liquid drop version of it, where the actual nucleons are separated. This is sort of an older view. This is just going in advance. If you go on the Saxon-Briggs model, and actually the actual investigations of the actual diameter and stuff like that, the actual neutrons and protons sit on top of each other. The 2 protons have spin up, spin down, and the neutrons actually sit physically through each other in space, and then the electron actually flows through each other. Outline the features of the strong nuclear force. Now, this is perhaps a more difficult one. So, the strong nuclear force, one feature is it is far stronger than the Coulomb force. So, there are 2 forces. The protons wanting to go around. It's far stronger. It's a very short range, 1 femtometer, 2 femtometers around that. It is an attractive force. Let's tick off some of the boxes. And it operates on, it doesn't operate on electrons, but it does operate on neutrons and protons, hadrons. It's a hadron. It operates on things with quarks rather than things with leptons to go through it. Now, I'll check out, but I think the old view, which if you sustain the view of the ball liquid drop molecule, or sorry, the quark molecule, if you believe the quarks are individual microparticles, which of course doesn't fit with quantum mechanics, you'd have to say that to get the quark having a physical distance, you have to actually have the a repulsive force, to have something of a physical size. Now, I don't know where this comes from, and where there's a repulsive thing to actually keep the quark at a particular distance. So I think there is a belief that if you, I'll just see what they've actually answered. If things are sufficiently close, they're repulsive, which I suppose. But this is true also for electrons. Electrons don't not fall into the nucleus because it's a very short distance repulsive force coming along. They actually go right through the nucleus. And just let's see what question it is. Oh, there it goes. I've looked at question part A, and it is, you have to say, at least state that they're made out of quarks. You have to draw it. And it does, let's see. The strong nuclear force is much stronger than the Coulomb repulsion force, so it should be attractive, and acts only over very small distances. The strong nuclear force is extremely attractive, tick, for nucleons one femtometer apart, but, i.e. this is not for electrons, but decreases rapidly at distances greater than 2.5 femtometers. Okay, so the force becomes repulsive at less than 0.7 femtometers. Well, this is, you know, depends what group of physics you're looking at. Part B, distinguish between the processes of nuclear fission and transmutation. Well, nuclear fission and transmutation can, so nuclear fission only occurs in very large nuclei, whereas, and in that, a very large neutron-rich nuclei, depending just specifically on the addition of additional neutron, or sometimes spontaneously, will split into two equal chunks. So you'll get two new daughter nuclei of roughly 50 that will add up to the original number of nucleons involved, minus a few neutrons produced. So there's a few things about nuclear fission. Nuclear fission can generate two daughter elements and a range of neutrons, and that's splitting, whereas transmutation is the conversion of one element to the other. So that's normally done with neutrons, because that's easily to do. So a neutron is added and the actual element increases in nuclear in the isotopic mass, and then undergoes a radiation to be another element, emission of a beta particle. But you can actually get transmutation by the with an accelerator, where you actually add alpha particles or protons if you're lucky, and through exchange. So transmutation is one element changing to another without a daughter element being produced. We'll check on that. I'll check on it when I check on the next one. The diagram shows, and you can't see it, or I can see it, components of a nuclear reactor. And so they have a general square of a moderator. Embedded in the moderator is fuel elements, and inside the fuel elements, presumably there are control rods. The control rods are down, so this is a cool nuclear reactor. Explain how the label components work together to produce a controlled nuclear reaction, and I say it's for 3 marks. So the fuel elements contain the fissile material that, on the impact of a slow neutron, will break apart under fission and produce more neutrons, more fast neutrons. 1 mark. The moderator, made out of, normally out of, so you would say uranium or something like that, uranium thorium. The moderator is a material, usually graphite or water, for which the neutrons do not stick but lose energy, therefore increasing their cross-section to make the fuel element, for when they do intersect with the fuel element, it makes fission going across, because you have to actually put it in the moderator, fuel element in the moderator, to make things go. And the control rods are normally out of boron metal. These are a neutron poison, so when a neutron hits it, the neutron stops. It can transmute mutation, but it doesn't release energy. So the control rods suck out the useful neutrons, which would allow the energy across, and this gives you a controlled nuclear reaction. By putting in the control rods, you control the nuclear reactions. So just let's have a read back and see how we've gone here. Transmutation involves an atomic nucleus turning into another element by radioactive decay or nuclear bombardment. I wish I could say that. Nuclear fission involves splitting of an atom into smaller, similar-sized fragments due to the capturing of a neutron. Well, this can be a spontaneous fission. However, the process releases energy and, I'd say, neutrons. So it can be, both processes can release energy. That's an important point. Here, the few elements, the fissile material, it releases energy and high-speed neutrons. When the neutrons are split, the moderator slows the neutrons down so they can be captured by the more fissile atoms, which are then split. Yeah, well, this is poorly explained. The control rods absorb neutrons and limit the number of atoms undergoing fission, thereby controlling the release of energy. That's a good answer. So I can answer it, but my quality and speed of answering is not necessarily there. So I have to improve. Now here we go up to the end of this, just two pages. The diagram, which is an emission spectra, shows the red to violet of the hydrogen emission lines. It's not red or light, it's grey with the actual lines. One at 656.2 nanometers, which is your N equals 2 standard emission line, and going up to some violet. So that's, it's to the N equals 2, that's N equals 3. N is the principal quantum number of a single hydrogen atom. 3, 4, 5, and so on. And then they've got the Balmer series to actually give you a clue in. The Lyman series and the Balmer series is visible light. And so if you know it's visible, you know what to do. With reference to Bohr's postulates, I think there's three postulates. Stable orbits don't radiate and transitions. Stable orbits don't radiate, transitions emit light, and the orbits must obey a increase in an angular momentum of h bar or 2. Just off the top of my head, though, I think so. What it is, bear in mind, I haven't looked at this for a while, so you have to reference those. There's postulates, I think there are four postulates. The gall of him actually coming after Einstein and putting up postulates just to, so he gets his explanation can float. Explain how the line at 3.0, so that's 3, 4, 5, 6, the 5N, is produced. Support your answer with calculation. So the Bohr postulates state that it's stable energy, that the electrons are in lines, and it also states that they without radiating, and it also states that emission is between these when an electron jumps, inverted commas, nothing makes me sicker to hear this type of stuff, jumps from an orbital to another, and emits a light. So in this case, an electron has been promoted to the N equals 5 principal number, principal quantum number orbit, and it has decayed down with the emission of a 434 nanometer one. Now support your answer with the calculation. So it means plug in the Rydberg formula, given this in the exam, that Rydberg's energy, so it's going to be 1 on lambda, and then it'll be that really funky, it won't give you the answer in EV, it'll give you in lambda, so it'll be 1 on lambda equals the Rydberg constant, which is something rather about 10 to the 7 in wave numbers, or into 1 on n squared minus 1 on n final squared, so final minus initial, so it's 1 on a quarter squared minus 1 on 25 squared, and you just plug it in, and you should get 434 nanometers. I don't know if you have to actually go through the calculation. You just have to say that calculation will be there, having marked it. And of course, his instructions to answer the second set of questions in a specific set of pages. So you just have to be cued for that if you're actually sitting a HSC exam in New South Wales, you poor things. We've done C. Well, that was quick. That's four. Oh, how would you get the 4 marks? I don't know. I should go back and actually check that. So just okay. So 4 marks. Explain the production of the line with reference to Bohr's postulates. Tick. Support the answer with the calculation. Tick. I don't know how you. Oh, and there's ways that you lose the marks. I'll read it out to you. Bohr's postulate states the electron's orbits and fixed energy levels only when the electron jumps from a higher energy to a lower energy level. It emits light in the form of a photon. Postulates. The specific wavelength of light can be determined by Rydberg's equation. Blue light is part of the Balmer visible series and therefore NF2. Okay, and then you can say by 5 and just they've put in the calculations. Answer could include taking clues from the diagram, which I did, and I did it the other way around. So let's get back to this. Okay, question D, another 5 marks together. So there's five mark questions. Some are 4, some are 5, and 1, 6 at the end. We're on the fourth one, D, part one. How were stable electron orbits in the Bohr model of the atom incompatible with the prediction of classical physics? Well, it's a prediction of classical physics that a accelerating charge will produce electromagnetic radiation. And if it's emitting power by classical physics, the orbital energy the energy of the orbit will reduce and the particle will spiral in towards the nucleus, releasing more and more energy. How did de Broglie and Davidson-Germer contribute to the modification of the Bohr model of the atom? Okay, this is actually, in terms of nuclear physics, rather esoteric because quantum mechanics came along. But de Broglie suggested that rather than actually an orbit, it was a wave going around the outside, and the wave was quantized because you've got the nodes. A wave in a string has got so many nodes, so that there's the wave there. And Davidson-Germer actually fired electrons through a nickel crystal. They're lucky; they annealed it and formed a nickel crystal and saw diffraction, proving that electrons do have wave-like properties. No kidding. Okay. Okay, let's read what the answer is for that one there. Sorry about this. Okay, whole page for that one. And coming on it, what they said is a stable electron orbit is necessary for the Bohr orbit to work. This would mean the electron is constantly accelerating, but since accelerating charge give off electromagnetic radiation, the electron would lose energy and go towards the nucleus. Okay. I don't know how. You just have to rote learn that. Okay. D. Since classical physics could not explain the stable electron, the de Broglie modeled the electrons as standing waves in the nucleus. That would have got the mark. Being associated with wavelengths, hence the only integer multiples of the fundamental wavelengths were possible. The idea was validated by Davidson-Germer through the electron scattering experiment, which proved evidence that the electrons were waves. Okay, here's the 6-mark question, and it's actually quite a complicated one, because for 6 marks they don't give you a lot of clues. Explain how the properties of protons and neutrons contributed to their uses as tools to investigate matter. A tool to investigate matter is a neutron beam and a proton beam. And so I'm fortunate that I've worked in the Pellitron at Melbourne University. They had a beautiful proton beam there. So the properties. So a proton beam is something that you can use. The proton beam uses the property of the mass of the proton and the charge of the proton to accelerate the proton, and the fact that the proton responds to a magnetic and electrical field allows lenses to be produced. And then when the proton decelerates, it creates a production of energy through Bremsstrahlung when it decelerates, and it glows. It also has a charge, so the actual amount of protons going through can be measured by the charge. So there are all the series of properties for a proton beam. For students, they'd never be taught any of this in the course. Neutrons, I wonder if it is protons. Neutrons, so the proton goes a short distance into matter but produces a lot of information. A neutron has the following properties: that it's got no charge, and because it only responds to the strong and not the electroweak, the electromagnetic force, it can actually flow right through matter. So a neutron can actually go through a shipping container, a pyramid of gas, or it can actually be dropped through a person, through a ground. And then it also has the property that it transmutes sticks to properties and emits characteristic radiation through transmutation, showing what the actual elements there are. By characteristic gamma rays, so it's a beautiful thing. It actually goes in, makes things radioactive, and the way it makes it radioactive tells you what material is, and it can actually travel a large distance. I'm trying to finish this off relatively quickly and see how I've done there. Of course, this is not me sitting down and writing it. This is me just rehabilitating my brain from unpacking it from ice to see how it goes. Okay, so outlines the properties of protons and neutrons. I did say a proton had a positive charge, a neutron had no charge and goes across, and that neutrons stick to atoms. Outlines the uses of protons and neutrons for investigating matter. I should have said investigating matter a bit more. And there the uses. Relates the properties to the uses. I think I've done those things. Sample answer. Protons and neutrons have almost identical masses, but the proton is positively charged and the neutron has no charge. Having the positive charge allowed the protons to be accelerated at very high velocities in particle accelerators. The protons then collide head-on with other protons. Producing particles which can be detected through their interaction with large detectors. Okay, well, protons can be accelerated and actually knock out a neutron, for instance. That's how you make F18 for PET, for proton stuff. And then it can break. It can be used to smash things and get the properties of... I suppose the properties of matter, they could have thought, I was thinking bulk matter, but you can get just the property of nucleuses by the interaction scattering. In studying normal matter, protons cannot get close enough since they are repelled by the positive nucleus. Okay. No, they channel through. They can actually hit a nucleus. They definitely can hit a nucleus in terms of stuff like that. Okay. Instead, neutron beams can be fired at nuclei in a process known as neutron scattering. Well, yes, neutron scattering and a whole heap of other things. Since all matter is a dual particle wave in nature, neutrons have very small de Broglie wavelengths. Can what have very oh yeah and can produce diffraction patterns, giving us detailed models of atomic and molecular structures. Yes, so they can, and of course the neutrons actually decay, and so they decay, giving out radiation. Well, thanks for listening. I didn't get as many rude surprises doing this quantum quark as I got doing the medical stuff, and it's given me gist. I have to get back to you by doing a full MRI story. This is getting back to it, to other things. One of the things I do note is that there's a lot of poor explanations out there where they just miss the overall point. They see a model, a representation of a model, and assume make assumptions on that. So that was reasonably good. The thing that I find a bit hard is the Bohr liquid drop model. Possibly the protons having to hit other protons is another weird one which is in there. But yeah, this goes overall that if you are left to your own devices and as a student just before the exam do old exam papers and then get back and actually read the answers provided by the examination committee, it will distress you. Not necessarily if you're in a hothouse school where they've got the same areas embedded in the notes and it's a circular thing, but if you're from outside that hothouse zone, you'll find yourself in trouble. Now, people overseas will find this overall quite interesting, I hope, and probably listening to it. If you're in other overseas countries, you'll be able to listen to where we are in teaching sort of neoclassical physics and how we're attempting it. It'll be quite interesting, and if you're studying in general, it'll probably be a help to you to listen to this, and it's a help to me because it's getting me slowly improving in my teaching skills, and hopefully they'll let me back into the classroom. Politics being set aside. Thanks for listening. In the meantime, keep on thinking, doing, and teaching science.